Return to Northmoor, episode 20, running time 30 minutes. Hi, and welcome to the Return to Northmoor podcast. This is Tim.
And Doyce.
So we are going to do some wrap-up episodes for you. Rather than taking you blow-by-blow through the rest of the Return to Northmoor campaign, we're going to summarize what you could do from here on. The whole idea of Northmoor is that it branches based on how your characters brought their stories to the table. And pretty much from the point where we left off in our last episode to the future, the branching is pretty serious. And as a result, we're going to sketch out the world and what you could do, and we're also going to give you some background fill-in about what the history thus far has been, so you can really take the campaign into the future on your own from here. The real life campaign ended due to, as you might expect, personal issues, just like we discussed on the very first show, so I don't have more material to bring. The way that the SRD and 4A licensing works after it was all said and done makes this much harder to do than it was in the 3E. A lot less appealing to do it.
It's just hard to even release it as free stuff, or...
Well, there's two things. So one is that the stuff you can use is much smaller.
In terms of what you can reference or...
And in how you release it and everything is much more complicated and much more dicey and more risky than it was.
I'm going to put on my indie publisher hat for just a second and rant about that. If you think about how big a jump 3.0 was above the second edition of D&D in terms of audience, because it made everybody a game designer or made everybody who wanted to be a game designer based almost entirely off of that SRD.
Yes.
I have to wonder, how should I put this? What the hell they were thinking with 4.0 and just cinching that down so tight?
Well, there's two things. First of all, they didn't completely close it off, and there are people who publish things, but what they did is they made it a lot less attractive. A lot less attractive.
It was very cottage industry. I mean, in my opinion, what you could do with 3.0 and 3.5, it was very DIY. It was like Makers, you know, for role-playing games. You
could and everybody who had ever run a campaign at home, which was everybody who ever played D&D, could now publish it and theoretically make money off of it. The problem was there was the giant glut of crap.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
And 90% of everything is crap.
So. Right. And so that was the problem, is that they wanted to avoid that giant flood of stuff that was really terrible that tarnished the brand.
For me, there was enough brand recognition where you could kind of go, okay, well, I got one thing from these guys and it was really crap, so I'm not going to get that. Whereas, oh, it's Green Ronin, I think I can probably trust them. I don't really feel like JoeDarkAgePublishing.com, who decided to put out three things based off of his old campaign, is really truly damaging the Wizards of the Coast brand when Wizards of the Coast comes out with their next Forgotten Realms supplement. I mean, I don't really feel like people are going to not buy that because Joe's Dark Age thing was
burden on the retailers.
Yes.
Because the retailers absolutely are like, I don't know what to carry and so forth. And so the retailers really complained about that. And then, of course, Wizards was really like, well, we want a piece of this pie, and we feel like we're one player among thousands, and we'd rather be one player among five or six.
Fair enough.
I think there was a lot of that was more about, let's bring the brand in a little tighter so we have a little better control over it, you know, to help retailers, to help avoid the glut of product again and all that. But then the other part of it was, we want a piece of that action. Yeah. In fact, we want the biggest piece of that action. And here's where they've actually won, and this is the good side of the story, in my opinion. They made it harder, less attractive, but they didn't make it impossible. But then what they did, it turned around and put out a lot of really good product. The stuff they put out in the compendium.
You have to do if you're going to limit things like that.
Exactly.
You've got to then replace in the market what is missing with your own stuff. And if you can do that successfully, then go you. For instance, One Bad Egg, which we've talked about, you know, decided not to continue to do products. You know, it just got to be too much of a hassle for them. But Rob Donahue's writing for Wizards of the Coast.
Right, exactly. So subvert your enemies, right? Instead of letting them go off and publish and make money sideways, just have them write for you.
Well,
and that's where Wizards has really done a great job of saying, yeah, we're going to limit it a little bit, but we're also going to take the best of what's out there and bring it in and turn it around and put it back out as products from us. And we can do that because if we offer freelancing for us, they'll probably take it.
Yeah. So, hey, Rob, there you go. Backhanded compliment. You're one of the best in that scenario that we just proposed.
Right. And as a result, your side company went away because, you know, Wizards just keeps putting out enough good product that people aren't starving for another way to get the material they need.
If you're a player who's only ever really bought traditional TSR stuff, and I say TSR at that point in time on purpose rather than WotC, the idea that somebody's out there putting out Sorcerer is not only kind of weird, but it's almost kind of offensive. Like, where does he get off? The company doesn't even have a name. It's just wrong. Right. And so there's a little bit of mockery going on there and stuff. And then everybody becomes a game publisher. Everybody, even if it's just a PDF, they make a $2 PDF of the thing. And hey, I'm a game publisher. And that, to my mind, actually made people more open to the idea of the indie gaming design community
yep.
coming up with all this stuff. It made them more open to that concept. It wasn't us versus them. It wasn't crazy elite hippie bastards over here and then the people who play regular games. It was we who design stuff for D&D and these guys who design stuff, but we're all building game yeah. stuff. Which isn't to say there weren't lines drawn in the sand and then marked with people's various versions of internet bile and urine. It was better than it was.
Yeah, much in the way that iTunes kicked open the door for people actually paying for music downloads.
Yeah.
And they had to do it with DRM at first because no one would let them do it any other way. But over time, they were able to turn off the DRM and everything else because the door was kicked open. Much like that has happened in the music industry, having this door kicked open with all these D20 PDFs
right.
suddenly made it like, wow, okay, making a game PDF isn't cheesy anymore. It's the way you make money
it's
in the gaming
a good
industry.
Way to, it's a good way to distribute your product. Right. You won't often find me going, yes, I thank iTunes for doing X, but in this situation, yes, they had what I think is a positive change to the music industry, certainly.
And I think a lot of the market for people who are looking for D&D stuff that's not by WotC are actually being lured away by the indie games that have nothing to do with D&D at all.
True. Paizo certainly has a very, sure. should I use the word rabid? A very enthusiastic following.
Well, much like other media, the long tail has come. The front is doing great. D&D is leading the charge well, but now there's Paizo in the middle, and then all the rest of us down the long tail are spread out, and the small little niches are all over the place. And it's better to be your own niche than to try to grab onto the head and be
yeah,
your own
exactly.
niche in the head.
Long tail publishing, the idea that, you know, you can continue to reap some benefits from something into perpetuity is it made tremendously more viable as an option when you're talking about electronic publishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you're not talking about having to keep 50 boxes of the book that you had to print yep. 1,000 copies of in order for the printing to be remotely
No, you put affordable. Your PDF on your website that you pay $5 a month for, and if you get one sale a month, it pays for itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. D20 Clut burned everybody's opinions out that only D&D would do. And now people are like, oh, it's okay if it's a game that has nothing to do with D&D. I'm willing to buy that. I'm willing to try it out because I can pay $5 for a PDF
yeah.
and try it. Another reason that we're doing this wrap-up is that the actual play audio did start getting pretty hard to follow. People off in separate rooms having conversations that didn't get recorded to the point where even releasing it raw, I would not feel comfortable that people could follow it without oodles of follow-up questions and so forth. I'm not saying I'm going to give up, but it's definitely on the back burner trying to get that stuff out. What was the goal of Northmoor? It was to do something new that hadn't been done before, which is to bring out an adventure that you could run in podcast format to make it easier to do it on your commute, to have someone guide you through the process as opposed to having to self-discover it.
In doing something new with the podcasting, you ended up doing something that was somewhere between that Dragonlance saga, 15 modules in a row, somewhat on rails, pretty clearly on rails, and a complete open sandbox, which would be like, here's the Forgotten Realms source book, no modules, go.
Right.
Make up whatever you want. You came up with something sort of in between where here's some big chunks of stuff that are sort of setting related right. and the Tinker Toys to connect them all to pat you on the back a bit so you don't have to hurt your arm. I mean, you did come up with something a little different. It's modular.
So we've been successful with that, I think, from Return to North, where we've had a lot of great comments. There's lots of people running the campaign and they're often doing it. And we don't want to leave those people hanging, even though right. we're not going to go through the rest of the campaign in as much detail. So what we're going to do is sketch out for you what the future could look like. But remember, the whole idea is that this is the story of your characters. We're just going to sketch out some things that might get in their way.
Another box full of blocks.
And the other thing I just want to mention is that the patiobooks.com site is taking up a lot of my time right now. I'm working on a new version of that to try to pay homage to some of the stuff that really got me into doing podcasting in the first place, to pay back the community a little bit there. So stay tuned for news on that front, because it will eventually circle back into what I call Patio Adventures, which is sort of what we're doing right now. Let's go ahead and launch into what the goals of the setting are. The idea is there's a lot of different terrain. You could have any kind of adventure in this. We didn't want to limit it down to this is only a desert and there's only one kind of tree or anything like that. Believably remote, however.
One of my favorite things about the 4.0 setting.
But the world is in a moment of change. I think every great story of
Epic fantasy.
Epic fantasy is that the world is in a moment of change. This isn't a story of this year's just like any other year.
It's your kicker.
One of my big problems is I have this, what I'll now call the J.J. Abrams syndrome from Lost, where you throw a bunch of crazy stuff and you really get people excited and you get all this stuff onto the table, and then you go two seasons and you're like, okay, now what do I do?
Because I can't actually explain the polar bears in a session.
Right. Well, and the whole idea is if you're going to have a campaign that goes from levels 1 to 30... ideally, something that happens at level 30 relates to something that happens at level 1. There's got to be some sort of overarching, at least thematic thing. In Buffy, for example, the last episode uses one of the very first villains.
Yes. To a certain extent, the stuff that's introduced at level 1 is going to be of some concern in level 30. That may be a trope of the epic fantasy genre.
Mm-hmm.
But to a certain extent, if it's character-driven stuff, then yeah, it should probably... although I would say that's a long time for a character issue to go unresolved. But certainly elements can still be there.
Exactly.
To use Buffy again as an example, a lot of the same characters are still there, but they're very different.
Yeah, they're different people by that point.
Season 2 introduces one of my favorite bad guys who, by the end, is sacrificing himself for everybody to be saved.
Right. You
know, Spike.
So a lot of the things that I sort of set up in the early parts of the adventure, the coins and the rods and who's chasing whom and all that stuff, the idea was to set up mysteries that wouldn't get resolved for a really long time. But then what I found is that the characters sort of forget about it and stop caring. And they're like, okay, yeah, there was that stuff. And unless you're immersed in it and unless you have the episode with the pop-ups beforehand to kind of explain to you what happened previously and you keep bringing that stuff up, mysteries... if they're drawn out long enough to sort of lose their sizzle.
One of the reasons I'm here, guys, because I didn't actually play in Tim's campaign, is I'm sort of the guy who sits there and goes, well, here's another game that we've played that maybe addresses that problem and deals with it. D&D is a Swiss Army knife. D&D is a Leatherman tool. It is extremely versatile, and you can have six people sitting there, and they're all kind of playing the different game, and everybody can be having a good time, even if they're not all playing the same game or enjoying the same aspect of it. Because it's a Swiss Army knife. Somebody is playing with the knife, and somebody else is playing with the scissors, and somebody's got the tweezers out, and that's all fine. The knife in a Swiss Army knife is fine, but if you get a knife that is only for cutting things of a certain type,
you can cut bread with a Swiss Army knife, but you can slice bread with a bread knife.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes, but you cannot open a wine bottle with a bread knife, though I have tried.
Yeah. Wow. Part of what I'm thinking of here when Tim talks about this, about the losing track of some of the story elements in the campaign, my mind immediately goes to, okay, well, that's something that D&D really doesn't help you do. It doesn't help you remember. There's nothing built into the game. The soft parts of the game, the role-playing parts of the game, are frequently the system is convince the GM that you're right. And to a certain extent, D&D relies on its GM a lot for that part of the system, which is fine. Yes. But if the GM's not good or even thinking about or just distracted about keeping that part of the campaign active in everyone's mind, the D&D system's not going to help you.
No.
So I immediately think about, well, what kind of systems would do help push that? Certainly there are ones out there. Each one of these games that might be good at that may give up something else in order to be good at that. Dogs in the Vineyard. Every single character has to have some trait on their character sheet pertaining to the fact that they're a dog.
So right on their character sheet is the leg from the past that brought them to this point.
Right. So every time you want to bring in those dice and use it, which, I mean, come on, we're gamers.
Right.
So we want to bring those dice in. Every time we do that, we're reiterating to the table and to ourselves that this is my relationship to this key element in the story.
And if some story element comes up later in the game, that gets added to your character sheet if you choose to as an attribute that sticks as long as it's relevant.
Again, you're reminding yourself of it. The game is helping you remember this because of the fact of it's going to make you remember it every time you pull that stat in. There's a game out there, and I love this game, and I kind of don't love this game, Conspiracy of Shadows. There's a newer version out than the one that I've got, so I'm not speaking about the current version, but the game is great. It's a little bit broken, but what's neat about it is that it's broken because there's all these great modular bits that were never quite screwed together all in alignment with one another. Mm-hmm. But those individual pieces can be unscrewed from each other and bolted onto other games really, really seamlessly. And
precisely because they're not tightly coupled, they're easy to break off.
Yeah, exactly. This particular one is the mechanic is called your doom, your character's doom. Maybe a theme that you want to hit is, you know, fate versus choice. Or it could be some element in the game that you want to not forget about, like the coins. Your character has a doom that you write up when you're making up your character. Like, and the one that always sticks in my mind is, I will die within inches of my goal, was the doom that I always thought was like just a lovely one. And it does not have to come to pass. You don't put this on your character sheet knowing that you're going to screw yourself out of it.
It's like any prophecy.
Yeah. I will die within inches of my goal. The way this works in the game is that if you're in a conflict, the doom is rated from 0 to 6. It starts out at 0. And the first time that you invoke your doom, you automatically win whatever conflict you're in. You get it.
But you're one step closer to that happening.
And your doom goes up by 1. When you describe how it is that you win that conflict, it has to, in some way, shape, or form, foreshadow that doom. That doom does not have to come to pass. You don't have to use this mechanic. And how much you use it, certainly if you're at a 5 and you know that 6 is the end point, that's going to be a different time than when you invoke it for the first time. If you do invoke it that last time, again, you win the conflict, but you've pretty much moved into end game with your character and you've said, we're coming up on the big finale and I'm going to die within inches of my goal. That will happen pretty much in the next scene that you're in. You might not use the doom, but for just a few seconds, you think about that doom that you have in the back of your head that I will die within inches of my goal.
I think the advice, if you're not going to bring in anything extra mechanically or conceptually like that, with is if you're going to have something, wrap up the plot quickly, but leave it somewhat open, like the classic sequel for a movie where, yep, the movie's over, but there's a tick for a sequel. And then that can come back later, and it can be that thing that happens in level 30 without it feeling like it's completely unfinished, just nebulous and out there. It can be like, oh, that thing that we defeated where it wasn't quite dead is much cooler than it just sort of being totally out there and never quite finished.
And you can cheat in terms of the story stuff. When you throw a lot of weird stuff out there, some of it's going to stick. Some of it's going to flop on the floor. Figure out the stuff that sticks and roll the stuff that fell on the floor into the thing that stuck.
Yes.
So that weird stuff can be subsumed by the giant katamari of the plot ideas that actually work.
If you had a note that you thought was going to be really cool and people looked at it and had no idea what it meant, you go on with something else they thought was cool and then you just say, well, that note fell out of that guy's pocket.
Right.
And it was just detritus of his passing and not something.
It can be small because everybody kind of wanted it to be small. Yes.
The whole idea is, what do these characters care about? And then you grab that stuff and move on to it. And that will make your life easier because they will give you the plots.
Yeah.
So don't get so attached to your plots that you won't let that happen.
In this last Diaspora game that we had, one of the characters has got, I'm on the run and one step ahead. And I decided to play up to that with an enemy that they were dealing with who knew this character's history. And was threatening them with exposing them. And, you know, all the people that are hunting for them are going to know where they're at. And that sort of thing. And by the end of the session, due to some pretty good play by the players, that guy had kind of retired from the life of pirating, sold his ship at a loss, and decided to become a dirt farmer on a planet full of carnivorous plants. Because that was a better option for him.
Yeah. So plot closed.
Except plot not closed, because she hasn't given up those attributes. So now we graduate that plot. That guy's gone away. It's like the pilot in a TV show. In this case, the guy is like, oh, I know your secrets. And he's gone. Except now the real bad guy shows up.
Right.
And the real bad guy is hunting her down. And the real bad guy goes to the guy who's been eliminated from being a threat, who's now dirt farming.
Puts the squeeze
and says,
on him,
I need to talk to you. You know, and that guy then becomes the guy who stays with you for the entire season arc, hunting her.
And how could you possibly have found out? Well, that guy you thought was eliminated, well, he's not acting against you.
He's
eliminated.
He's not acting against you. Yeah. But there's lots of ways that you can do that and sort of roll all that stuff.
Yep. So one of the other things is that deep personal connection for the PCs. In my opinion, a good D&D adventure is one that's about the characters, and that if you can take a D&D adventure and any characters could play that adventure, it's a bad adventure. The classic sort of living city, living Greyhawk, living Forgotten Realms adventure where any 6 random dudes could show up and take care of this adventure is in general far less appealing to me than one where only these 4 people, I mean, like Harry Potter. Only Harry Potter can do what Harry Potter does because of the way that the story is written.
I don't know if it's a bad module. I'm not using the word adventure the way you did. I'm going to say, I don't know if it's a bad module. I don't know if it's a bad scenario. I think it's not nearly as interesting a story.
Right.
I'm just tweaking your statement just a bit.
My frustration is that when you have a story that absolutely ties those characters in, the amazing amplitude you get out of that by saying, I'm not doing this because I'm a mercenary and any old mercenary could get $5 and do this job, but this is tied into me, my past, my being here, my relationship with whatever's going on, personal motivation, it makes it a lot less difficult for the GM to throw things in the path that the characters care about rather than saying, hey, there's this adventure over here, and I'm going, not today.
We were talking about that traditional role-playing truism of the GM has the plot, and the players decide what their players do, and it's the very clearly defined line between those two. Or, summarizing it that other way, the GM contributes the nouns, Right. The players control the verbs. And that generic adventure where anybody can step in that role and do it is sort of built on that premise.
Yes.
And there should be nouns in the hands of the players. There should be verbs in the hands of the GM. It's shared. Even if you have to hide it from the people who are going to be scared about having nouns, you kind of need to do that.
Players who aren't the GM type players who are going to bring their own stuff to the table, even people who are there to be entertained, are much more entertained when the story is about their character than when it's about an obstacle course.
Yeah.
In addition to the characters sort of being central, which you can do in two ways, one with the worksheet thing at the top level to bring them back in, but then secondly, in taking what they care about, going with that, letting the other stuff go.
In your experience with Northmoor, mm-hmm. you talked about throwing a lot of weird stuff out there.
Right.
And some of it just being forgotten about over the course of...
Yep.
Was any of that weird stuff connected to the things that those guys had come up with in terms of their character worksheet? And if so, did that connection to the character worksheet help preserve that and keep people aware of that element going forward into the campaign?
Yeah, absolutely. The coin that was their mentor's, the one that they found in their mentor's eye patch in the one that we ran, was definitely more of a thing where they're like, hey, this is Kontos's coin. Whereas the other stuff was just like, yeah, here's some MacGuffins to put in our inventory.
Right.
Right.
You know, it has much more weight. Maybe that's the truly soft way. I came up with like the thing on the Conspiracy of Shadows for the other idea. But, you know, just the idea that if you, especially with Return to Northmoor, if you're using that character questionnaire, anything that you're throwing out there that you really want to have, there's some things that are just so head-slappingly obvious, I almost feel like I'm insulting people to say it, but this is this is the truth. The things that you want to linger, to have weight in the campaign and have a memory in the campaign, you want people to constantly be aware of them and not let that fade into the background. Either they need to be tied to the character or characters, or the characters need to be tied to them.
Right, and more by the fact that they just picked it up.
Yeah. I did a fantasy game a while back where, much like your questionnaire, during the process of character generation, I laid out the... And I didn't really have a scenario in mind. I just had a situation in mind, figuring that the actions that the players would then be taking would kind of make the machine go. And it turned out to work. But in that situation, I had a list of about... I had built a network of NPCs. Mm-hmm. Here's the Baron and his daughter and his sister-in-law who he's secretly sleeping with, and the captain of the guard and his two main baronets, and the priest who's in charge of the temple, and the main nun that everybody loves because she's gorgeous and she doesn't seem to realize that everybody wants to marry her. And during character generation, simply said, pick two people off this list. Tell me how you know them, what their relationship between you and this other person is, and how that relationship is theoretically at risk. Where's the stressor in that relationship? There were NPCs that we just forgot about.
Because no one got tied into them. Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's not going to be about the priest. It is going to be about the nun, because every single person was pointed at the nun. All I had to do was squeeze the nun, and everybody at the table winced. And the stuff that you want to linger, you got to connect to the players, the stuff that they care about.
Absolutely. So in terms of enemies, what I was really looking for is someone who is really motivated to do stuff over time, that they're not going to give up on their evil plot just because they got their butt kicked. They've got something that they're really, over time, trying to achieve, and that repeated butt kickings, even to the point of eliminating particular NPCs, isn't going to stop the train.
So they're going to act like a player.
Yeah, exactly. if your NPCs give up as easily as minion monsters do, then over time, you're going to lose steam. But I wanted that. Very motivated enemies. The classic, well, I can't tell you because whoever is squeezing me is much scarier than you.
Yeah, exactly. My motivation when I'm coming up with bad guys, and this isn't just gaming stuff, this is story writing stuff too. Like, the simplest rule I've ever heard of, which I quote frequently enough that it's like it's mine, is that the bad guy in the story never thinks that he's the bad guy. They have a reason for it, for whatever it is that they're doing, unless they're insane, and even the insane ones.
Well, in D&D, we have this special kind of insanity called evil.
Nobody really thinks of themselves as evil. They think of themselves as...
having a higher degree of moral swiveliness in order to achieve their goal.
Because what they're doing is important enough. They're doing something that was very difficult, but they're doing it for reasons that they feel are good reasons.
And they're just more willing, perhaps, than the PCs to compromise what the PCs see as morality to get there.
Yeah. Playing through Mass Effect 2, my favorite character in the game right now is a character who is one of the guys who's responsible for not a genocide, but a entire race's sterilization. And he did it for the best of all possible reasons. He did a horrible, horrible thing. And you can't help but like the guy. And in fact, you can't help but kind of agree with him when he's explaining it.
But if you were just to write out what he did on paper...
It's a horrible, horrible... He could easily be the villain in the story. Just tweak things just a little bit. I mean, he's got a couple of rules in place that, you know, basically he won't experiment on any creatures that can do calculus. That's his rule. Never broken it. It's easy to take a bad guy and say, look at this guy for a second as though he were the good guy. because that's how he sees himself.
As we go into the enemies that the PCs face, we'll talk about why they're motivated to do what they're doing and why they absolutely do not believe they're the bad guy. The other theme that I wanted to explore is what I call direct and indirect horror. So direct horror is that sort of, oh my God, there's something gross and horrible right in front of me, and it's right in my face, and oh my God, what am I going to do
with it? We'll call that fringe horror or bones horror.
Or X-Files horror.
Yeah, the goo on the camera in the opening scene that makes you go, ugh.
So that's the direct horror, but then the indirect horror is when you start to think about the ramifications of that.
We'll call that dollhouse horror.
Or I call it Cthulhu-type horror.
Yeah, sure.
Well, the fact that there's a nasty thing here isn't that bad. It's the fact that that nasty thing is the harbinger of something really, really nasty that probably means the end of all of civilization that starts to really creep in on you, especially when that unreels slowly.
And the reason I call it the dollhouse horror is because of the idea of being able to program somebody with a personality. On the face of it, it's more icky than it is creepy. Right. Because they're basically usually prostitutes or something like that. But then you start to think about, well, okay, this guy has taken an imprint of his personality, and he, whenever he gets bored with this body, he just has an imprint on another one, essentially assuring himself immortality at the cost of wiping out another person's personality or a series of people's personalities. And it just sort of snowballs from there to the point where
bigger and bigger ramifications of what was already sort of icky now becomes like, holy snikes, that's nasty.
The guys who are in power are literally using the rest of the planet. Then it gets downright creepy. We've done it to ourselves, and then it gets away from us, and now it's reprogramming everybody, and we've made our own Cthulhu.
So when I definitely am a huge Cthulhu fan, every D&D game I ever ran always turns to Cthulhu. In fact, that became the running joke for years. Well, how long before this fantasy game becomes Cthulhu? We'll start taking a pool now. Well, guess what, folks? From day one, Northmore was Cthulhu, and we'll talk about how that is the case.
Awesome.
What I wanted to make sure we explained is that how can we do that Cthulhu-like horror in the tropes of D&D? We're not playing the Cthulhu role-playing game, which does that horror very particular ways. Yeah. We're playing D&D, but we still want that horror to exist. And when you have a sword that you're pretty sure anything you're going to fight, you could take down with that sword.
How do you do Cthulhu? Because there's rules. D&D is, at its core, small unit wargaming tactics.
Against even opponents.
Yeah, somehow balanced. And when you have something that blasters don't affect it, it's going to feel like cheating. Unless you approach it very carefully in a game like D&D.
I want to make sure the PCs are effective, because nothing's more frustrating in a game like D&D, a classical war game turned role-playing game.
When you start out as the level one pig farmer.
Yeah. Than being immediately put up against stuff you have no ability to deal with. You know, at least in Cthulhu, you can always do some ritual. Any Joe Blow can pick up the book and start reading, and you theoretically could close the gate.
Don't recite Latin in front of the old books, people. It's rule of thumb. Whereas
in D&D, if I'm a 10th level character and I'm ineffective against everything all the time, the game is completely broken at that point, because the whole game is about how effective are you.
One of the great joys of D&D is leveling up and becoming more effective. One of the big payoffs of that game is taken away.
What I really wanted to focus on is what makes D&D D&D and not any other fantasy game. How is this not Tolkien? How is this not Song of Ice and Fire? What is it that makes it D&D-like? With the horror focus, and of course, what jumps to mind is what in 4E they handily called the Far Realm. Here's the little branch of Cthulhu that's directly connected to D&D, and we're going to put it off then. We're going to put all the Cthulhu-like monsters from D&D in there. Illithids, Beholders, Gibbering Mouthers, all those things. Suddenly, that becomes the palette that we're going to paint with instead of orcs and kobolds. And
I don't think all D&D ends up automatically being Cthulhu. You can do...
Well, no, my D&D always
ends up being
Cthulhu.
Your D&D always ends up being Cthulhu. Now, that I'll grant you.
No, so what I'm saying is that typical D&D, in the early levels, you're painting with a palette of orcs and kobolds and humanoids, which is the same palette that you have in Tolkien.
We call that palette green.
Exactly. The Gobbo palette.
Right? The Gobbo palette.
Whereas I really wanted to have the palette be more of a Cthulhu palette of aberrations and things that just aren't natural.
We call that palette Squamous.
Yes, exactly. The Squamous palette. The idea is it's still D&D. It's still everything that you love about the game, because it's monsters you can fight, monsters you can defeat, but the colors you're painting with aren't the same ones that Tolkien had.
Yeah, they're not green. They're green with some really horrifying adjective in front of it.
Yeah, exactly. However, the irony is that all those monsters that make D&D so crisp and D&D-like are exactly the ones that you can't publish and write your own products around.
No.
Which is something that I came to know after I went down this train, because the license, as everyone may know from the history of 4E, came much after the game premiered and after we were already playing and I was already writing and everything else.
So, okay, back me up, because I don't publish stuff in D&D. So all of the monsters are ones we really can't talk about, or which?
The idea is that there's what they call the iconic monsters from D&D, which includes Mind Flayers, Beholders, that sort of thing.
Yeah, those don't exist. That's D&D in a nutshell.
And then that's what I wanted, the most D&D campaign I can make. And those are exactly the things they're like, if you publish your own products, you can't use this stuff.
Because that's clearly our stuff.
Orcs, exactly.
Not our stuff.
Exactly. You
know? Goblins, not our stuff.
And that's why the Paizo people went crazy with kobolds, because kobolds, not their stuff.
Really?
Yep. Kobolds are as generic as can be. They go back to Brothers Grimm in every possible way. Every sort of goblin.
I would say goblins were even more generic.
Yeah, but kobolds are just another word for goblins, some of their culture's
version, absolutely.
Right? Whereas these other monsters are exactly the palette I wanted to paint with, and were exactly the palette that it turned out after I started painting, I couldn't paint with.
Yeah.
Sort of frustrating in the end.
Well, yeah, that's sort of the WKRP in Cincinnati. Awesome show that will never be rerun because nobody can afford to pay the music licensing fees to rerun the show anymore, because who knew at the time that they made it that everybody was going to be screaming bloody murder about re-airing those songs without paying
royalties on every rerun.
And you did the
rerun.
Same thing. It's like, well, I already made the show and now I can't ever, you know.
Yeah, exactly. We made 100 episodes. Why aren't we getting our syndication fees? Well, because you would lose it on the royalties for the songs.
And then some.
Thanks once again for listening to Return to Northmore. Thanks to my co-host, Doyce, who you'll hear on the next few episodes as well. Thanks to all of you who are running our Return to Northmore campaign and sending me your campaign updates. A shout out this week to James Carruthers up in Canada, who's running a Return to Northmore / Keep on the Shadowfell mashup. If you're a knitter, spinner, or fiber artist of any kind, please check out Kim's new podcast, The Fiber Files, at thefiberfiles.com. We'll see you next time. You've been listening to Return to Northmore, a podcast released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 2.5 license by Tim White and Kim Stone. Our theme music is Charge of the Valiant from Dronolin's Tower, Legends of Cithulin Volume 1, Tales of the Long Forgotten, used by permission of its composer, David Alan Young. Find out more about their fantastic gaming music at dronolin.com. Visit us and many other fine podcasts at spookyouthouse.com.